Welcome to Creating Sanctuary, a global interview series featuring 21 heroes who are saving animals' lives. I'm your host, Yolanda Calderon, and the hero I'm interviewing today is Dr. Christy Kambler, the founding director of Compassion Without Borders. She's a veterinarian that has been working in international animal welfare and shelter medicine for the past 20 years. Dr. Kambler is a passionate advocate for vulnerable animals living in poverty on both sides of our border and has developed and carried out extensive international and local rescue programs. She has also pioneered extensive programs to provide access to veterinary care and spay-neuter to low-income, underserved communities in the U.S. and Mexico. Welcome, Christy. I'm so happy that you could join us.
Oh, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
So I first learned about Compassion Without Borders when my friend Janet was sharing photos of the beautiful dogs that you guys were rescuing. It was so touching to see that I had to support you guys and pull out the Visa card.
Aww.
You guys are pretty effective and you're doing amazing work. And so many of us have traveled to other countries and seen street dogs or street animals and thought somebody should do something, but you are actually doing something. So how did you begin Compassion Without Borders?
Well, Compassion Without Borders started about 17 years ago now, actually. And I was taking a break from academics. I was between my undergraduate and vet school. And I wanted to travel. I have always worked with animals, and so I wanted to find some opportunity where I could travel, work with animals, and use my Spanish. I spoke Spanish. So I did a series of internships in different countries, and I ended up finding myself in Mexico City, which is one of the largest cities in the world, and I ended up at one of the largest shelters in the world, which was a place called the Refugio Franciscano, which housed, at that time, housed about 2,000 dogs, most of whom were loose in packs, and then about 200 cats. And so I was very overwhelmed at that shelter, which was run by very well-intentioned individual, but was under-resourced and not a great place for the animals. So I ended up going there every single day and doing all that I could to help animals there. And there was one moment when I was there where things really I considered as the moment where Compassion Without Borders started. And when I would go to the shelter, I'd have to take a bus and then a subway. It was really on the outskirts of town. And all along that, you know, I'd see all the homeless, mangy dogs on the side of the road, and that was very sad. And then I'd get to the shelter, and there'd be these 2,000 homeless animals, and that was very sad. And that day when I walked in, I immediately noticed that one of my favorite dogs, a dog named Seraphine, wasn't there. And I found out that he had been killed in a dog fight, which sadly happened there quite a bit. So it was a very sad start to my day, and it was a very rainy day, which there was just logistically a nightmare because of having 2,000 dogs and the rain and the filth. And so I ended my day in they had this makeshift infirmary, which basically was where sick animals would go. And they wouldn't make it out. You know, they just didn't have the funds for medical care, so they would just kind of get sequestered. And I'd try to provide whatever comfort care I could during their final days. And when I went in there, I saw another one of my favorite dogs. Her name was Cha-Cha, and she was in the cage. And I was just absolutely heartbroken because I knew that meant that Cha-Cha wasn't going to make it either. So I just was so very sad that I sat on the floor in that dirty makeshift hospital, and from the floor I could see out a little window, I could see all 2,000 dogs, and it was raining and they couldn't find shelter, and then behind me was Cha-Cha and she was sick, and I was sad about Seraphine, and I felt so overwhelmed, and I felt like, what was I doing in this place? And given the magnitude of the suffering, what could I possibly do? And I just sat there, completely baffled and overwhelmed, until all of a sudden I stood up and I was walking over towards Cha-Cha's cage, and I went over to her cage and I was opening her cage, and I grabbed Cha-Cha and I got her out of there, and then we got her medical care and we got her adopted. And it was just It was that one thing I could do in the moment was to save Cha-Cha, and so that's what I did. And then everything just blossomed out of that. So then we started an international rescue program from that shelter. And then we started, airlifting dogs out of Mexico City. And then from there we started doing spay-neuter clinics and veterinary care. But it really all stemmed from just that one moment where the only thing I could do was the thing that I absolutely needed to do, and it was to save that individual dog's life.
And that's how it starts, one life at a time, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I've traveled to so many places and felt so helpless. So I really admire you for taking a stand in that moment, because it's so easy to just look the other way and say, I can't do anything here. But obviously, one individual can.
I mean, it is. I think that's the question we face when we're all of us in the animal welfare movement, is that we can either be overwhelmed by the magnitude of the suffering to the point of inaction, or we can just do the piece that we can do, you know?
And so how many animals have you actually brought back to the U.S. since you started Compassion Without Borders?
Oh, that's a great question. So over 5,000 at this point.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it is. And I feel compelled to say that it's also with, I co-founded Compassion Without Borders with my husband, Mancho. So it's all
great. Thank you
for
saying that.
Together and with all the support of everyone, we've been able to rescue those 5,000 animals.
Yeah. And they all get adopted here, right? You bring them back and then you find homes for them.
Yeah, so the way, you know, over the 17 years, things have changed, but the way we're at now and the way it's been for quite a while is we rescue them. They come from off the streets. We have a clinic south of the border that provides free veterinary care and spay-neuter, and so animals are dumped at our clinic constantly. And we also take animals from animal control down there. There's really no adoption program at animal control, so we're their only way out. So we get animals from a variety of methods down in Mexico, and then we have a rescue center down there. They undergo a quarantine, they're spayed and neutered, they're brought back to health because they're usually in very poor condition, and then we drive down and pick them up and bring them back. And now we have a shelter here in Northern California, and they go up for adoption here, and every dog usually has multiple applicants. They're very, very popular, and we strive to bring highly adoptable animals.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I've heard that actually Mexican street dogs make fantastic pets.
They do. So they really do. And usually once you have one, you kind of never go back. And what I attribute it to is that here in the States, most often a dog, you know, gets maybe put in the backyard, or if they're lucky, they're in the house and they get fed each day. But there can often be a lack of mental stimulation, or, you know, things are pretty much given to them. But a Mexican street dog, pretty much from day one, has had to use their wits and their intellect and oftentimes their charm to get food. And so they just tend to be a lot more sociable and smart and savvy and oh so grateful for the chance to have a home. So they make really interesting and engaging pets. They're wonderful companions.
Awesome. So I'm going to ask you a question that you probably get asked a lot. We have a lot of pets that need homes here in the U.S. So how do you justify bringing more animals in from Mexico?
Yeah, that is a question we get asked a lot. And so I always preface it with that our organization does help animals both in the U.S. and Mexico. And what we're about is finding communities where there's a void of adoptable animals. So I think that for most folks that aren't kind of entrenched in the animal sheltering world, they don't realize that a lot of communities in the U.S. have not enough adoptable animals. So shelters are sitting mostly empty. Adopters are walking in and not finding pets. They're turning to breeders. And so there's communities where there's been enough education, enough access to spay-neuter, and enough progress that shelters are in need of adoptable animals. And then you have these other communities where that's absolutely not true. And due to poverty, socioeconomics, a lot of variety of reasons, they have way too many animals, not enough resources, and animals don't make it out alive. So what we do is we find the points where there's too many animals and we bring them to the points where there's too few. And whether that's in Mexico or it's in the Central Valley, to us is really somewhat arbitrary. You know, for us, to save a life is to save a life, and a dog is a dog. And we think that dogs in Mexico have every bit as much of a right to life as dogs here in the States. And sadly, those dogs in Mexico often have much worse lives before they're rescued, and without rescue would face no chance at even a humane euthanasia. So their plight is so dire, and their value is absolutely every bit as much as a dog in the States, that we're compelled to save as many as we can.
Mm-hmm. You just brought up euthanasia, and I think I read on your site that they're still using electrocution in a lot of places. Is that true?
Yes. So electrocution is one of the probably the most common method of killing unwanted animals in animal control centers throughout Mexico. And we've been working on that issue for 15 years now. So we have a program where we work with the government to train their employees how to do humane euthanasia by injection, as we do here in the States, and also how to house the animals in a humane way, which is often lacking down there. So the program's been pretty successful. We were able to stop it in the entire state of Chihuahua, which was the first state that stopped electrocution in Mexico. And we have satellite. Yeah, it was a really big victory. And slowly, things are changing in Mexico, but sadly, it's not quick enough, and it is still a common, absolutely inhumane method.
So how do we get at the root causes of animal overpopulation and suffering in some of these areas?
Well, I think what I'm most proud of about our organization and our work is that not only do we go in and save these individual lives when they're in need of saving, but we work really hard to try to prevent them from needing to be saved in the first place. And the way we do that is very simple. It's most often just a lack of access to basic veterinary care and spay-neuter in impoverished communities. So people have companions. They can't necessarily afford the cost of veterinary care. That's true, you know, here in Sonoma County, and that's definitely true south of the border. And so those animals go, you know, without vaccinations, and then they die of horrible diseases that could easily have been prevented, or those animals are just breeding freely and making more unwanted animals. So by providing access to free and low-cost veterinary care and spay-neuter in those communities, you really tap into the very root cause of animal overpopulation, and it's the most effective and really only way to nip it in the bud and to try to prevent it from growing.
Mm-hmm. So you go to places and capture the street dogs or the street animals, bring them into the clinic, or you support organizations that bring them into the clinic, spay, neuter, and then release them again? Is that how it works?
So the spay-neuter program in Mexico, we also have one here in California, but in Mexico, there's two essential components to it. There's one that we call community dogs, which is kind of like a feral cat program here in the States. So there are free-roaming dogs in Mexico. Oftentimes those dogs are in okay condition. They're doing all right, and sometimes they're not. But we have a program for the ones that seem to be faring well, where we capture them, we spay-neuter, we vaccinate, we house them for a few days while they recover, and then we re-release them. So that's our community dog program. We also have a program for dogs that live with families, and those families just can't afford care. So we do about 20, 25 dogs and cats, I should say, a day. And I'd say 75% are animals that do live with families, and then the other are the community dogs and cats.
Oh, so these clinics are running all the time. They're running all year long, whether you're down there or not?
Yeah, so now in Mexico, we have an actual established facility. It's open 5 days a week. And it's staffed entirely by local veterinarians and support staff. So it's going all the time, 5 days a week. We've been open for about 2 years, and we're just about to hit our 10,000th surgery, I think, next week.
Wow. And is that in Mexico City or in that area?
No, it's in the state of Sonora. It's in a town called Puerto Peñasco.
That's amazing. Hats off to you, really. It sounds like you're actually making a huge impact there. Has the idea caught on at all in other cities?
Yeah. So prior to having this fixed clinic, what we did, what our model was to move around Mexico and find areas where we had a strong local advocacy group that had a connection with a veterinarian that was willing to work with them. And then we would come in and do trainings on how to do high volume spay neuter. We would come in, you know, 3 to 5 times, and we would then also provide the equipment that they needed to do high volume spay neuter. So I think we were able to establish spay neuter efforts in about half a dozen areas throughout Mexico. And then we've established fixed veterinary clinics in 2, in Juarez and in Puerto Peñasco.
And you were saying that you also run a spay-neuter clinic up here in California, in Santa Rosa.
Yeah, so we also do the same thing up here. So a lot of people think of Sonoma County and Santa Rosa as being very affluent wine country and aren't able to recognize that there are these pockets of underserved communities. But, of course, there's a ton of immigrants and migrant workers, and there's huge communities within Sonoma County where income levels very low and there's no access to veterinary care and spay neuter. So we have a mobile clinic, and we go out and do clinics in those hearts of those communities. We just set up shop in a parking lot or, you know, wherever we're most visible, and we provide care to those animals. We do monthly clinics where we do probably about 100 animals, just all the veterinary wellness. And then we do weekly spay-neuter clinics where we're doing about 15 to 20 animals a week. It's great work. It's really great work.
Yeah, and it sounds like you've been making a lot of progress. It's actually giving me hope. It's very inspiring. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, yeah. It's just kind of like head down and do what you can. And suddenly when you look up, you've done quite a lot.
Yeah. So why do you believe access to care for animals living in poverty is such a critical issue?
Well, I think when you look on either side of the border, what you find is that the animals that are living in communities where there's high rates of poverty, they just don't have any care at all. So they don't have vaccinations. They don't have deworming. They're not spayed and neutered. They have chronic skin, ear, eye issues that don't get treated. And so the individual welfare of those animals can be very poor. And it's not because family members don't love them. It's because they just can't afford it. I mean, here in Sonoma County, the cost of even basic veterinary care is prohibitive to even, you know, middle-range income earners. It's just extraordinarily expensive. And so what happens is those animals either languish without care, or here they get turned into shelters because people can't afford them. So what ends up happening is you turn the animal into the shelter, and I was a shelter vet for 10 years. Family loves them. There's a deep bond. They can't afford them. They're trying to do what's right. Then the shelter turns around and it takes the animal, pours all their resources into treating them, but then also has to pour resources into housing them and finding a new adopter when that animal already had a family that loved them. So I think it's a broken system, and I think the best way we can curb overpopulation and improve welfare for both the animals and the families who love them is by giving them some sort of safety net and allowing them to stay in the home, giving them access to care, and keeping them where they're safe and loved. And I also feel very strongly that, you know, I grew up in a low-income household, and I can tell you that animals saved my life. And so I just don't think that the benefits of animal companionship, the health benefits, the emotional benefits, should be limited to well-to-do people. I think that people of all different social economic levels should be able to have animals and benefit from them.
Wow, I totally agree. So what's your story? How did you know, at what point did you know that you wanted to dedicate your life to this kind of work?
Oh, gosh. So I think I'm sort of the classic animal lover, veterinarian. From where the moment I could walk, I was just drawn to any dog in the room or any animal in the room. It's just been a passion since as long as I can remember. And I really did. There was a point when I considered not becoming a veterinarian and maybe going into farmed animal protection, or I was trying to figure out where I could be most effective for the animals. But it was actually that moment with Cha-Cha when I was sitting with her and I realized exactly what I stated before, was that I wanted to become a veterinarian because I wanted to be able to treat a homeless dog like Cha-Cha when she was sick and suffering and needed care. I wanted to be able to provide her with that care, but I also wanted to be able to prevent Cha-Cha from ever being in that position in the first place. So I decided to go to vet school.
I hope a lot of young people are listening to this and get inspired to do what you did, because it's just a great story. So what are some of the biggest challenges you face in running your organization right now?
Oh, let's see. Right now, our organization is in the fortunate position of being in a period of fairly rapid growth. So we got through a bequest from our partner agency, the Center for Animal Protections and Education, wonderful group out of Grass Valley, we got a portion of a bequest they received to purchase our own shelter. So we have had this shelter now for a year, and that's caused tremendous growth. It has been a wonderful opportunity for us to have a hub for our work and to build community, but it's been a lot of growth. And at the same time, things in Mexico have been expanding. So I think the challenge with growing is you want to do it sustainably. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure that you have the infrastructure and the resources, both financial and staff, to grow and not to overstretch people and not to compromise the quality of your programs. And so I think we're in that delicate balance right now, figuring out how to grow in a very sustainable way. And it's hard when you're looking at such big issues of animal suffering and such huge need to try and narrow your focus and to not overdo it. You know, we're all so passionate in this field and we're all driven by that passion, but I think you have to be careful to focus it and not to overdo it, because the threat of burnout is so real.
Yeah, that is actually one of the questions that I'm asking everyone too, is how do you keep from burning out and getting compassion fatigue?
Yeah, it's a great question, and one that I really appreciate animal welfare professionals exploring. You know, for me personally, it's a constant day-to-day, not I don't want to say struggle, but something I have to be mindful about. I am on the front lines out there pulling the dogs and rescuing the dogs and treating dogs that haven't had care, and cats for a long time. And I see a lot of very intense suffering firsthand, not all of which I can alleviate, some of which all I can offer is euthanasia. And that's really hard. But what I've found to be the only way to navigate it is to allow myself to feel it. So to very intentionally, if I've had something really sad happen or I've witnessed something really heartbreaking, just to create a space where I can kind of grieve it and I can cry and I can work through it and just to let it move through me and then come out the other side. And there's a real release in that for me. So I think not running from the sadness, but really kind of just sitting with it, let it move through me, and then moving on from there, not dwelling in it.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful, actually. Instead of trying to push it down, just allow yourself to go through it. But make sure you keep moving through, right? I mean, you can't stay in that grief. It's really easy to stay there sometimes.
It is. No, I mean, sometimes I'll literally, like, you know, put on a sad song and just cry my eyes out. But then it's out, you know, then I felt it and it's out. And there's a physical and emotional release. And I think you just have to be really intentional about where you're allowing your focus to go. So if I know I'm going to be able to grieve it, then I can kind of not have to carry it all day. I know that evening I'm going to be able to process it and get it out. And I don't just, I'm not buried by it constantly. But it's a big one, and in any sort of, I think, animal welfare, social justice, compassion fatigue, and I've definitely experienced it. I can tell when I'm having a bout of it, and I just try to be really careful to do a lot of self-care when it's going on.
That's helpful. So my last question for you is, in terms of animal welfare, what is giving you the most hope right now?
Oh, I think the farmed animal movement and vegetarianism, which is really different than what I'm working in. I'm just so inspired by a lot of the newer groups that are doing some really creative work on veganism and vegetarianism, and I do feel like we're seeing a shift in that whole arena, which is such a big realm of animal suffering on our planet and planetary suffering. So I'm really inspired by that whole movement. Within my sector, my little piece of animal welfare, I think I'm constantly inspired by how communities respond when they're given a chance. So I don't know that this is so much like a trend in the field, but it is something I find inspiring. So I think a lot of people write off low-income communities and underserved community members in all sorts of ways. But when it comes to having animals, you know, they just don't care. They shouldn't have them. They're lazy. They won't come. That's just not true. These people come and they stand in a parking lot for like 5 hours in the rain to get access to care. They love their animals. They do things that a lot of other people would never do. So I find their commitment to their animals really inspiring, and I find it really motivating for me to want to be able to give them the care that they want. You know, I'm inspired by how much they truly love their animals.
Yeah, so just giving them the opportunity and seeing how much they come forward when they have just a chance.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's unbelievable. These people, they wait and they wait, and they do anything to get their animals care. They just can't afford it. And so I think it's a measure of their love for their animals that can't be defined in monetary terms.
Right. That's a beautiful way of putting it. Christy Kemblor, thank you and your husband so much for the work that you do and for your time today. And I also want to thank our listeners and encourage them to go to your website at cwob.org. And you'll see some beautiful, touching videos and really, really inspiring. Thanks for the work you do, Christy.
Oh, thanks for the interview. I really enjoyed it.